Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's the frustrated boomer of free speech, because if you knew what was going on and you were a boomer, you'd be frustrated too. So go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, send the badly needed shekels to 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Phone it into 1-800-724-2719, extension 3. Operators are standing by. Mark Collett, welcome to the show.
Hello, Patrick. It's good to be here. And big change is occurring here in the UK as we speak. We have just we've just seen the resignation in Scotland of Humza Yousaf. Humza Yousaf was Scotland's first minister. He obviously is of Islamic Pakistani, I believe, descent. And he's gone. He's walked. He's finished. He's out. And his lasting legacy will simply be that he was the man who brought in the most draconian hate speech legislation that Scotland could have ever imagined. That is his legacy, is his hate crime, or hate speech, should I say, legislation that, you know, will fundamentally be used to rob Indigenous Scots of their rights to speak freely. And it's quite interesting, really, because largely speaking, he did get the job because of his ethnic makeup. That's the fact. I remember at the time that there was quite a lot of pressure heaped on people within the SNP to vote for him on the basis that if you weren't selecting Humza Yousaf, you were in a position where fundamentally you were going to be seen as a racist, because this is what, you know, people call progress. You know, progress is fewer white people in positions of power. That is progress. And if you're standing, same with the Tory party in, you know, across Britain, you know, progress for the Conservative Party was a man of Indian descent. It was Rishi Sunak. And there was a lot of things being said at the time. I remember when Liz Truss defeated Rishi Sunak to become prime minister. I remember it clearly, because I remember there were people in the Conservative Party that said, if people don't want Rishi Sunak, you know, if we don't choose Rishi Sunak, that is an endorsement of racism. That is basically proof that the Conservative Party still has work to do, you know, to get rid of racism. And much was the same in the SNP. You know, people were having to more or less say, well, I'm not voting for Humza Yousaf, but it's not because I'm racist. It's because I genuinely believe that this is a better policy for Scotland. This is important, and I believe in something different to him. You couldn't just say, well, I'm not voting for Humza Yousaf because I don't like him, because he's not the right guy for Scotland, because, you know, that was something you could not say. That was something that wasn't allowed to turn around and say that you weren't voting for this man because you didn't like him fundamentally meant you were a racist. You were part of a problem. And I still to this day find that really, really interesting. You know, it's a damning indictment of this system that if you don't vote for the ethnic minority, you're now a racist. You know, it's everything you do is basically an action that you're judged upon. And if you take the wrong course of action, you are proving that you are part of the racist problem that Britain apparently has. And the interesting thing with Yousaf, and this is quite interesting, is that everything he's done since he's been in has been absolutely terrible. This isn't a guy who got his position because of his, his ability. He got his position because of his ethnicity. And as I said, that is now something that people are probably going to be looking at and saying, well, was this a good idea? Well, not for the SNP, because obviously we're coming up to elections and we've got a general election looming, which will likely be at the beginning of next year. And this isn't going to bode well for their party.
So for one brief but glorious time for maybe a few weeks, you had a situation where, of course, the UK was led by Rishi Sunak, and then Scotland, which is part of the UK, but it has its own home rule government, if that's what it's called. It had this Yusuf, what's his name, the Pakistani guy.
Humza Yusuf.
I know Ireland's not part of the UK, but it makes up the rest of the British Isles. And it had this guy who was like half Indian and 100% gay. And then Wales. Wales couldn't be left behind. And it had a choice between a black guy and a gay guy, and it chose the black guy. And so for one brief but glorious period of time, you had pure diversity, not a white man in sight. But I guess the gay Indian in Ireland resigned a few weeks ago, and now Humza Yousaf is on his way out. Does that mean that the return to white indigenous rule in Britain?
It certainly doesn't. And I think there's an old phrase which sums this up perfectly. And that phrase is, quite simply, diversity means fewer white people, and totally diverse means no white people. And that's exactly what we've seen here. You know, Britain's... let's just take a second to discuss who are the most important people, or who were the most important people in British politics. So in British politics, we have four people. So you have Great Britain. Now, this is a little bit of a sort of a history lesson before we get started. You've got Great Britain. Now, Great Britain is England, Scotland and Wales. It's the mainland. Then you have the...
And Great Britain is the name of an island, right? It is.
Yes.
It is Big Island in the Isles.
Yeah. Great Britain is England, Scotland and Wales. That's what it's made up of. Then there's the United Kingdom, which is formally the formal name is the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So the United Kingdom includes Northern Ireland. Then there are the British Isles, and the British Isles include everything. So the British Isles include England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And that is the British Isles as in the group of islands. So that's basically how it's broken down. But we'll deal with Great Britain. So Great Britain is England, Scotland and Wales. And the four highest positions of state in England, Scotland and Wales are the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, Indian. The First Minister of Scotland, Humza Yousaf, Pakistani. The First Minister of Wales, I forget his name, but he's Ghanaian. And then finally, you have the Mayor of London, because London is obviously the capital city. It's hugely important. It's one of the most important cities in the world. I think it's got about a population of about 12.5 million people, which is obviously a lot bigger than some entire European countries. So you have a situation there where these
Who is the Mayor of London?
I sort of made the unfortunate assumption that everyone would already know that. That's Sadiq Khan. He's, Pakistani Mayor of London. So basically, all of those four positions of state, the four sort of highest elected positions of state, are all people, or were all people, who were not of indigenous descent. And that tells you something, which is sort of incredibly important and illustrative. And it is that the indigenous people of the British Isles have been sort of colonized from the top down as well as the bottom up. So this isn't just a matter of us being replaced from the bottom up. We're also being replaced from the top down, as all important positions of state have been occupied at one time by people who are not of indigenous descent.
Right. And, you know, you're seeing that in the United States. It's obviously we had the 8 years of Barack Obama, who's black, but he wasn't even American black. Right. It would be one thing if you had if it was an American black. But he wasn't an American black. His father was from Kenya. And then, of course, now we've got this woman as vice president who very easily could become president, given the elderly and decrepit state that Joe Biden is in. I call her Chlamydia Harris because I think that's funny. But she, both her parents came to the United States in temporarily, actually, in the 1960s. And so she's half Indian and half Jamaican. And then her father, I guess they were married, but they got divorced and the father went back to Jamaica. And then the mother moved on to Canada and she was raised at least partly in Canada. And of course, she's married to a Jewish man now. We get that. We had just very recently the establishment trying to force Nikki Haley, Nimrata, what's her family name? I'm not sure what the name she was born with, but she's a Sikh Indian, but trying to force her down the throats of the Republicans. We get an awful lot of that here, and it's getting kind of tiresome. The thing is, like, the American people have been so, brainwashed, and what are other good words to use? Demoralized. So nobody wants to say anything. Yeah, because if you complain about it, you're going to be accused of being racist. And then, of course, now we've got the Biden administration. And, these Indian people, the black and brown people, when you get down to it, that's really, as we know, that's not where the power lies. And, I was just watching a YouTube video from some analyst, and he was talking about stuff going on in the White House and the communications department, just in the communications. And he's talking about what's Anita Dunn and her husband, something Bauer, and then Jeff Zients, who is the chief of staff, was getting involved, and dropping all these names. Every single one was Jewish, but I mean, you can't even say that. At least with the Indian people, for the most part, you look at them and you know who they are. But in America, people don't even know. So I'm just throwing that out there before I kick it back to you, Mark.
Well, that is an interesting point. And it's an interesting point because ultimately what you're saying is that it is extremely jarring for people in Britain who see that their country is completely taken over and dominated in this way. So politically, we are completely dominated by these Indians. That is something that I feel is jarring. It is, people look at that and they do feel uncomfortable, and they do talk about that. But you do make an extremely good point that when Jews assume positions of power, they essentially look just like white men. And this is why you will constantly hear this from people. Oh, well, old white men rule the world. And then if you point out that all the old white men that happen to hold this power are in fact Jewish, that's a point where people get very angry. But normal people, especially sort of your boomers, I don't like to get into what I call boomer bashing, because I don't think it's particularly productive. But, boomers are a group that just simply don't notice this and class these Jews as white people, just white people. But interestingly, these Jews don't class themselves as white people unless it's expedient to do so. So, for example, if a Jew was speaking to a large crowd of boomers, he'd say, look, I'm white and I'm Jewish. And he would make it clear that, he's with these he's with these old boomers, he's part of them, it's just a different religion. But obviously, when the time comes and we're talking about diversity hires and we're talking about, structural power, all of a sudden these people are then, in fact, Jewish. And we've noticed that in the UK, you will have Jewish professors. I can't remember the one from America. Was it Brett Weinstein? Was that his name?
Who are we talking about?
Quite a while back, and I made a video of this at the time, there was a professor in an American university, and the university had a day for colored people, and he turned up on campus, and they were like, no, you don't count. And he's like, but I'm Jewish, so of course I count. I'm sort of your ally. And when it turned out that they viewed him as white, he became almost sort of a folk hero for the sort of American, you know, American sort of controlled right, that he'd stood up against this sort of day of color. But, you know, he was one of the people who had, I read somewhere at the time that he'd allegedly been someone who argued for the day of color and was all in favor of the day of color until they, you know, came to the conclusion that he wasn't one of the people who would benefit of it. So he came into work as normal, you know, like, oh, I'm a minority too. And then when they treated him like, you know, one of these old white men that apparently control society, at that point it was, you know, you need to go home. And then he became, rather than an actual white man, he became almost the voice of the disenfranchised white guy at the university who, you know, who wanted some power back, which was obviously very interesting because, you know, he'd obviously flip-flopped between multiple positions.
This reminds me of, and that guy, he got on Tucker Carlson's show and he did become a little bit of a folk hero for
a little bit. I believe, and I, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was also on Joe Rogan. Now, obviously, Tucker is, I'm not saying Tucker is not influential, but Joe Rogan, you know, is the host of the biggest podcast on the planet. And if you get a seat on the Joe Rogan show, that's, you know, you're in that chosen bracket. You know, the seats on the Joe Rogan show go to two types of people. One, people that are extremely influential and that are being built up for some reason. And two, people who are Joe's friends. So if there's somebody on the Joe Rogan show that isn't massively popular and isn't a isn't sort of a household name, usually that person is on the show because he is Joe's friend. And that's kind of how the situation works. And I'm pretty sure that Brett wasn't Joe's friend. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure he wasn't one of, because when Joe has his friends on, they're usually people who have something to do with mixed martial arts or people he personally finds interesting.
So first of all, I'm a boomer, so I watched almost every one of Tucker's shows on Fox, and I have almost never watched Joe Rogan because I don't even know what a podcast is. But I saw an analysis of Joe Rogan's guests. You know, you're talking about his guests, and somebody they put together a list of the thousands of people that he's interviewed over the years on his podcast, and it classified them into, you know, athletes. Obviously, he likes the mixed martial arts, comedians. Joe Rogan, I guess he thinks he's a comedian. I don't know. I do remember him actually, who's on The Man Show.
He was a comedian. That's where he got his start. Joe Rogan was a stand-up comedian. And
he just wasn't very funny.
I'm not going to start saying whether he was and wasn't funny, because that's obviously subjective. But Joe wasn't the guy that was... I'm not going to start saying whether he was and wasn't funny, because that's obviously subjective. But Joe wasn't the guy that was, you know, packing places out as a comedian. However, he did begin to sort of pack places out once he was, his sort of natural place became the guy who was doing the MMA commentary. That's when Joe Rogan became sort of a household name, when he was on doing the UFC commentary. And that's when he became sort of like super friends with all the UFC guys. And at that point, he became this household name. His podcast really took off. And, you know, the Joe Rogan Experience, as it's called, became the de facto. You know, if you're listening to one podcast, you know, you're listening to the Joe Rogan Experience.
Yeah, if as long as you have tolerance to listening to stoned people. I mean, he smoked marijuana with Elon Musk on his podcast. But anyway, I'm not here. I'm not trying to bash him. What I and he did. There was a show called the Man Show that was on Comedy Central, and it starred Jimmy Kimmel and Adam Carolla, and it launched them both into really high profile careers. And then they got launched, the next host was Joe Rogan and some other guy who I don't think got launched into a career. And that kind of flopped, but it was a good step along the way for him. So at any rate, somebody did an analysis of his thousands of guests and divided them into politicians and mixed martial, you know, athletes, comedians, political commentators, things like that. And then looked at the proportion of Jews in each category. And with the exception of the mixed martial artists or the athletes were disproportionately not Jewish. But most of the other categories, it was like 25% Jewish. You know, I'm just saying, that's just a piece of information.
Yeah, it was, I know the guy who did that. He runs a channel called The Leather Apron Club, and it's a very good channel on YouTube. I'm not saying he should be kicked off YouTube. I'm just saying I'm surprised he hasn't been kicked off YouTube, because Leather Apron Club does talk about things which are, you know, things a certain group doesn't want us talking about. And one of the things he talked about was the percentage of these Jewish guests on the Joe Rogan Experience. And the Joe Rogan Experience is something, as I say, extremely popular. It's a show that, you know, it's a podcast that, you know, a lot of people like. It's a podcast that, you know, is very, very popular. This isn't something that's, you know, it's not a fringe thing. It's extremely popular. And, you know, he does absolutely, you know, prioritize Jewish guests, which is, again, very interesting. And this was all laid out. And obviously, Brett Weinstein was one of these guests, one of these people who was sort of put on a pedestal, one of these people who was fundamentally raised up as someone that at the time everybody had to listen to. And I found this quite interesting, because Brett became the guy who was almost at the forefront of this whole anti-woke, if you like, pushback in universities. And obviously, according to what I read anyway at the time, and, you know, I might be mistaken if somebody goes back and finds I'm getting this case mixed up with another case, you know, fair enough. But what I read at the time was that he was actually all in favor of the woke policy, that actually the woke policy was something that he quite liked, until the woke policy sort of came for him, so to speak. And at the point the woke policy actually came for him, he was he completely changed his opinion on this, and then became almost, if there was one, the almost official sort of counterfoil to the woke policy. So he was the guy going around speaking out against it, saying how terrible it was, and, you know, was the voice of the voice of the common man on campus, which was very interesting, because obviously, you know, if, you know, this information that I'd seen is true, he was all in favor of it until it, you know, came back on his particular group. And once it had come back on his particular group, he wasn't so in favour of it. And I kind of always saw that as a way that accurately sort of showed that these people often dominate both sides of the political debate. And we already talk about how they control sort of both sides of the House here in Britain and America, but they also control both sides of the debate when it comes to, you know, woke policy making, if you like, which is quite interesting because obviously, you know, to ensure that you always win any argument, you control both sides. And that's always what I saw with that. And when he appeared on Joe Rogan, again, very interesting. But that just underlines what we're saying. People see him as a white man, whereas these people that we're talking about in Britain, they're not viewed as white. They are very much viewed as, you know, others. So, you know, if you ask the average British man, you know, is Brett Weinstein, who's Brett Weinstein when all that was happening? I'm sure most people have forgotten him by now. But if you ask the average guy, you know, who is Brett Weinstein, they'd be like, oh, he's that white college professor that stood up against the wokeness, you know. Whereas if you, on the other hand, asked people, you know, who is Rishi Sunak, they'd be like, oh, he's the British Prime Minister, but he's Indian, you know. And it does make it very difficult for people to spot the influence that Jewish individuals have. It's the same in Hollywood. You know, if you see sort of, you know, people like, you know, Scarlett Johansson, people would say, oh, she's that white girl who was in the Marvel films. Well, yes. But if you do actually look at the early life section on her Wikipedia, you know, she's actually, of course, Jewish.
Yeah, and I think she was a spokeswoman for some SodaStream, which is a Israeli company that makes carbonation machines and makes them in the West Bank settlements or something like that. Yep. So, you know, people look at you mentioned Hollywood, and a few years back there was a Twitter hashtag going around at Oscar time. Oscars so white, or Hollywood so white, because they were disappointed that, I don't know, Spike Lee's film wasn't going to get an Oscar or something like that. Hollywood so white. And, you know, it was a joke. Obviously, David Duke had a lot to say about that. I remember, the thing is, I call this the bat principle. In Asian cultures, bats are considered to be two-faced, because the bats will go up to the birds and say, hey, look, I got wings, I'm one of you. And then they'll go up to the mice and say, hey, look, I'm furry, I'm one of you. And, you know, they can do that. The bats do that. And so the Jews do it too. I mean, they'll go up to the minorities and say, yeah, we're repressed. We're minorities. We're repressed. And, but then when they get called out for some sort of crime, they disappear in a puff of whiteness. So one thing and the thing is, it's not just white people who don't see this. A lot of the brown people don't really see it either, and it doesn't always work to Jews' advantage. So, for instance, 15 years ago, there was the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I'd gone down to an encampment a couple of times. I went once with some Ron Paul people who brought a movie projector, and they were projecting an End the Fed film. They were projecting it onto the side of some major Wall Street bank, which I thought was really funny. But then the leftists who dominated the camp, they weren't sure whether they were comfortable with having these Ron Paul people. And so they had some sort of, they were going to debate it, right? And at the time, they had what they called a progressive stack. So the stack, I don't know if you use this term in the United States, in Britain, but the stack is the waiting line of people waiting to speak. You're in the stack. And they had what was called a progressive stack. And a progressive stack means people of color speak first, and then women, and finally white men can speak. That's the progressive stack. But the funny thing was, nobody really had anything to say for the most part. But there was this one Jewish girl who's like, well, I should be able to speak first because I'm Jewish. It's like, no, you're not. Jews are not a repressed people. You're not a marginalized people. You don't get to talk. That was kind of funny. But also, what's going on now with the massive demonstrations and the so many of the people in the encampment are they're Muslim, or they're Black, or they're Middle Eastern, and
you've got these Jews who are coming and saying, we feel uncomfortable, or we feel scared, in many cases, they're coming down with Israeli flags wrapped around them and getting in the faces of these people, and then, trying to get the cops involved. So a lot of things are going on, and certain things that often have worked out well for Jews, like, you're talking about this Brett, whatever his name is, sometimes it backfires, and I think a lot of things are backfiring on them now. So I'm going to kick it back to you, Mark, right, for your thoughts.
Well, I do think it's very interesting, and it's interesting for a couple of reasons, and I'm going to start talking about a different place, and I'm going to start talking about Haiti. And Haiti's a very interesting place, because every time there has been some kind of, sort of leadership or rule in Haiti, that country has looked at the colour of the leadership, and that country has obviously not always been amenable if the colour of that leadership is not the colour of black. It's not people of African descent, which is very, very interesting. And we've seen that in Haiti, because the first people they got rid of were the white people. And it was quite interesting, because on getting rid of white people, the problem that came about was that a new sort of ruling class emerged. And that new ruling class were people who were of mixed race origin, because there were a lot of mixed race people in Haiti. And these people were then got rid of, by got rid of, I mean killed. And they were killed because the Haitian, the Haitians had to blame someone. So they blamed the new ruling class, which were visibly different to the average Haitian, because they were, of course, people who had mixed race parentage. And I think if we get to a point, especially in countries like Britain, where there is such anti-white hatred fermented by the media and the establishment and academia, much of which is dominated obviously by Jewish minds, we will get to a point where there's going to be a huge amount of people who are of black, Muslim, Indian subcontinent. They have a, they're not, obviously, they're visibly, they're visibly going to be not white. And those people are probably going to look at Jews as whites. They're going to look at Jews and say, well, look, these guys are whites and they rule us. These are the old white men that we've been taught to hate. And at that point, there's going to be a very, very interesting shift in the dynamic of power, because I believe at that point these Jews are not going to be able to say, hey, look, we're Jews, we're different. And part of that will be because if they were to say that, they might even be in more trouble by admitting their Jewishness than they would be if they said, hey, look, we're white. And that's because of what's going on in Palestine. So it's kind of interesting that what's being done here in the West is very, very short-termist from a Jewish perspective. So from a Jewish perspective, this isn't a good long-term game plan. This isn't something where Jews will be like, you know what, this is going to work out well for us in the long term. In fact, it's not. In the short term, it is going to remove white people, and it might lead to certain things being extremely profitable. But in the long term, it's not going to create a society that is amenable to Jewish interests, unlike the 1950s and 60s. So you often find that leading sort of Jewish intellectuals, professors, etc., will talk about sort of the bad old days of America, when, America was sort of white picket fences, white people, Christian, they didn't like that. That wasn't something that they as a group liked. And, they then decided that they were going to change that, and change that they absolutely did. However, I don't believe they've changed it in a way that is going to benefit them at all in the long term. in the short term, they will receive benefit from that, probably financial benefit, power, etc. But in the long term, they have built their house on very, very shaky ground. And as we've seen in the UK, the quote-unquote far right, who have always been described as anti-Semitic, have never really posed a vast threat to Jewish power. So, you know, groups like the British National Party, even though they gained some amount of power in elected bodies, so we had 56 councillors, one county council, which isn't very many, by the way, because the total number of city and county councillors in Britain is around 20,000. So having 57 in total is nothing. We did have a seat on the GLA, which was something, and we did have two seats in European Parliament, which again was something. These things were, you know, important and fundamentally, they were good for us and for the British people, but that wasn't really a huge amount of power. However, Muslims, on the other hand, already wield a huge amount of power. They wield a huge amount of power over both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party on a national level, you know, on a parliamentary level. And they do hold the complete balance of power at local council level in certain towns and cities around the UK. Now that puts them in an interesting position, and it also presents a huge problem for Jews, because, you know, these Muslims do not like Jews. They are using their electoral power to prove this. They are voting in candidates that are very critical of Zionism and of Jewish power. And I think this presents an interesting future for Zionist power and Zionist control in the UK. You know, Muslims are not going to be amenable to that. And I would say, if you were to do a poll of, say, white boomers and said to them, look, you know, do you like Jews? I should imagine most of them would be, well, yeah, you know, at least, yeah, they're okay. You know, right through to, yeah, they're great. There would be an overwhelming number of people that would be somewhere between, yeah, they're okay, and yeah, they're great. Whereas if you actually look at Muslims and you said, do you like Jews? And people were answering honestly, I think you would probably have a much larger number who were, you know, at the very least, well, I'm skeptical of them, right through to, you know, no, I don't like them. They're not people that I like.
I wanted to ask you about this. So, you know, both the United States and the United Kingdom have massive immigration problems and large contingents of non-whites. But we have a very different mix. You know, in the United States, we always had the blacks because of slavery, and now we've got the number one minority is Hispanics. They've eclipsed the blacks, but we've also got a fair amount of Asians. Subcontinental people, Indians and Pakistanis, not nearly as much. And we don't have a huge amount of Muslims. I guess there's a couple. We have, out of 535 members of Congress, I think there are two Muslims. So we don't have a lot of Muslims. Now you've got a lot of Muslims. And what you were saying about white people are probably the most philo-Semitic, certainly in the United States, they're the most philo-Semitic. I think Orientals, for the most part, are pretty indifferent. And maybe the Hispanics, who are maybe more traditional Catholics, are not super pro-Jewish. But in Britain, of course, you've got the two very large groups. One, the Muslims, often from the subcontinent, I guess mostly from the subcontinent, and you know, you describe them as having a hostility towards Jews, which I would think is mostly a result of these decades and decades of the oppression of the Palestinian people. But then you've got a large number of non-Muslim subcontinentals, the Indians, people of Hindu background, and and these people are very prominent in politics and in Britain. And my question is, the Indians, people like Rishi Sunak or Suella, what's her name?
Braverman.
Braverman. People, are they typical, or are the Indians very like willing accomplices of the Jews?
It's quite interesting because you do have people like Suella Braverman, and she is actually married to a Jewish man. So there is quite a bit of this, and Rishi Sunak has made it very clear he is highly philo-Semitic. He is somebody that is absolutely, 110%, pro-Jewish. This guy is not somebody who is in any way a guy that you would look at and be like, yeah, he's not an Indian for the Indians kind of thing. That's not what he's doing. He's not saying that he's not somebody who you would come down on and say, look, he is absolutely pro-Indian, or he's doing the best in this country for Indians. Now, in some ways, people would say, well, actually, Mark, you're wrong. And they'd say that because he has let in a record number of Indians. And he is, letting them flood in at a record rate. So he probably does some things that do indeed, benefit his people and, could be seen as pro-Indian. But and he's also had some trade agreements, with India that, could be seen as pro-Indian. But he is incredibly philo-Semitic, and with and everything that he has done post the 7th of October has been absolutely pro-Israel, to the point where they've just announced a new sort of pro-Israel initiative.
Bam bam, mon sas place, j'y sur mon lit à bouffer sa langue en buvant dans mon whisky. Quant à moi, peu dormi, vie débris, mais j'ai dû dormir dans la gouttière où j'ai eu un flash. En quatre couleurs. Allez hop, un matin, une louloute est venue chez moi, poupée de cellophane, cheveux chinois, un sparadrap, une gueule de bois. A bu ma bière dans un grand verre en caoutchouc. Comme un agneau dans son igloo. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. De s'envoyer du paillasson, limé, ruiné, vidé, comblé. You are the king of the divan, qu'elle me dit en passant. Ooh, I am the king of the divan. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi. Ça plane pour moi.
done post the 7th of October has been absolutely pro-Israel, to the point where they've just announced a new sort of pro-Israel initiative to bring Britain and Israel closer together leading up to 2030. So leading up to 2030, the British government is now seeking greater ties with Israel and are basically saying that, you know, Israel is almost like, you know, the way they're pitching it is that Israel is almost like, you know, Britain, but in the Middle East, because it's democratic, it's peaceful, you know, it's secular. It's all these wonderful things, which of course is not. You know, if I was to suggest in England that a whole group of people weren't allowed to vote and were to be kept in a big open air concentration camp, I would probably be locked up for hate speech or even put in a, you know, some kind of mental asylum. But that is literally how Palestinians are treated over in Israel. Unless, of course, they mean that Britain's going to be like Israel in the sense that the indigenous people are treated as second class citizens. That might be, you know, that might be what they actually do mean, in fact, you know, so who knows. But yeah, these Indians are absolutely 110% philo-Semitic, and probably almost as philo-Semitic as the Christian Zionists in America, in fact. You know, that's the sort of level of pro-Israeli, you know, butt-kissing that you do see from people like Rishi Sunak.
Well, that's very discouraging. We've only got a few minutes left, and I often like to ask you what you're doing on your own channels. Do you still call it Patriotic Weekly Review, where you have an interview?
I certainly do. However, it's sort of changed format over the years, and it is just me now. So it is just me doing an interview with somebody who is I choose to interview. So there's no co-host or anything. And it sort of transformed it from being kind of the panel show that it once was, because it used to be a panel show with a guest, to being really just me doing something a bit more like Joe Rogan Experience, if you like. Obviously not nowhere near as popular. I'm not saying it's as popular, but it's more like that in the sense of it is me having a conversation with somebody of interest on the big issues of the day or on what they've been doing recently. And yeah, it still continues like that. I think it's on episode sort of about 260 now, so it's certainly not slowed down. It takes place every week, and this week I've got a video out because I still do my weekly pre-recorded videos, and I also do a range of other streams such as book reviews and film reviews. So we did a book review last night called The Myth of, we were reviewing a book called The Myth of German Villainy, and I'm always up to something. And the things that I'm usually up to are sort of trying to effectively spread the message as best I can.
Mm-hmm. And what do you have up this week? What do you have in store for your audience this week?
Well, last week I did a video roasting Lauren Southern, because I don't know if you know that Lauren Southern's back, and she's back to tell all men in the alt-right that we're all awful and that we don't respect women enough, which is, you know, hilarious, considering women get such an easy ride in dissident politics, you know, earning a lot more money than their male counterparts, in fact, and being treated almost as instant celebrities overnight because there's such a male-dominated audience. But that's what I had out last week. And this week I've got a episode of PWR with Blair Cottrell from Australia. That'll be live on Wednesday at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. Eastern. So still plugging away with everything that I've ever done, and just sort of trying to make it work, you know, trying to keep the energy there.
Yeah, well, that's what we're trying to do, and hopefully there will be payoff in terms of achieving the goals that we want for our society. Well, I want to thank you for joining me, Mark.
It's been a great pleasure. I look forward to being here same time next week.
Thank you very much, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National People Radio.
Hercules, hero of song and story, Hercules, winner of ancient glory, fighting for the right, fighting with his might, with the strength of 10 ordinary men. Hercules, people are safe when near him. Hercules, only the evil fear him. Softness in his eyes, iron in his thighs, virtue in his heart, fire in every part of the mighty Hercules.